Welcome to KUOW's Speakers Forum, a venue for spoken word presentations in many forms. We feature writers, artists, storytellers, and thinkers recorded at events around Seattle, Washington. I'm your host, John O'Brien. Jessica Jackley was a liberal arts major who stumbled her way into the Stanford MBA program. Philosophy and business came together for her in 2005 when she helped start Kiva.org, the world's first person-to-person micro-lending website. Kiva facilitates lending to poor and underserved entrepreneurs and students in 83 countries. Jackley's new memoir is Clay, Water, Brick, Finding Inspiration from Entrepreneurs Who Do the Most with the Least. In it, she shares her impressions of the tenacity and resourcefulness of people who suffer from poverty. Her book details how harnessing the power of the internet helps them achieve their goals with little downside. Kiva started by filming and posting online the loan requests of 10 people. The organization has now served nearly 2 million borrowers, with total loan transactions approaching $750 million. The repayment rate is 98.66%. Jessica Jackley spoke at the Elliott Bay Book Company on Monday, July 27th, 2015. Thanks to Jenny Cecil Moore for our recording.
Thank you so much for the very nice introduction, and thank you all for taking the time to be here. I have heard that this is the first sunny day in a few days, so I get it. I mean, I appreciate it. Me versus the sunshine, that's a big compliment, so thank you for being here. I'm just going to speak briefly, and then I love that, you know, we have an intimate enough group that we can have hopefully some great Q&A afterwards, some great discussions, so I can understand what's on your mind as well. I want to tell you about two entrepreneurs in this book, and I'm going to tell you hopefully some details that are not straightforwardly communicated in the book. One is an entrepreneur named Patrick, who's the first entrepreneur I profile. He kicks off the book, and in fact, the title of this book is really in honor of him. Another entrepreneur is Fatuma, and she's the last entrepreneur I mentioned, and I think you'll figure out why as I tell you very, very briefly about their stories. So Patrick, I met him about a decade ago in Uganda. He had fled the northern area of the country to settle in a village right on the border of Kenya and Uganda, and he had left his home village because a rebel group had attacked them. He lost a lot of his family, but he and his brother made it out and fled and were able to find distant cousins to live with in this other area of Uganda. And they settled, but they were there after this very traumatic experience and had, you know, no shoes on their feet, the clothes on their back, very little education. They were homeless, you know, newly orphaned, and they didn't have much of anything. And I think a lot of people looking at their lives would have looked at them and said, these guys have nothing. This is hopeless. But Patrick didn't believe that that was the case. He knew that he had within himself the ability to change things for the better. And as he told me his story 10 years ago, one day he decided to, again, make things better for himself and his brother and those around him by doing this very simple thing. He was sort of sitting on the ground watching the sun come up, thinking about the day before him, and every day he had to figure out how to feed himself and his brother. And as he thought about that again, he sort of had this moment of epiphany, and he looks down, sort of dug into the earth, literally, right? We say these in cliched ways. Roll up your sleeves, get your hands dirty. He literally did these things, dug into the earth, and found some clay deposits near where he was sitting, right in the ground beneath, you know, his feet. He found some pieces of wood, some scraps of metal, and sort of dug deeper, mixed these bits of clay that he found with water, and was able to figure out how to shape that material into bricks. And so he started to make bricks with his own two bare hands. He was able to sell those bricks, even though the first were pretty bad. They were misshapen and rough and crumbled and cracked easily. But he got better and better at it, and he was eventually able to sell these bricks for fractions of a penny each. He did that again and again and again and again. He saved this little tiny bit of money that he could, and he ended up being able to buy a brick mold. Now imagine a sort of 8.5 by 11 sheet of paper divided in half. This brick mold was just something that allowed him to only double his production, but it was a very big deal because now not only could he make bricks at least twice as fast, but they were more evenly and consistently shaped and sized, and those sold for a little bit more. Now, he dried these bricks in the sun because we when you live on the equator, it's a great free resource to utilize. I don't know if it would work as well here during certain months of the year. But he dried those bricks in the sun and was able to make a little tiny bit more with each sale. And you can see where this story goes, right? He was able to eventually buy more professional implements, not just his homemade ones. He was able to buy a shovel and a trowel. He was able to be a much more official, kind of professional entrepreneur, and eventually was able to hire his brother, and then a neighbor, and then another. And by the time I met him, this amazing gentleman had a booming business and could even point to such changes in his own life, such as a new home that he had built out of his baked bricks that he had baked himself. Oh, that's the other part I have to tell you. He not only dried the bricks in the sun, but eventually learned how to bake them in a self-contained kiln, which really made sales go up, and he could sell things for more. So this amazing story of entrepreneurship. Patrick really exemplifies that to me. So that's Patrick, and I think he's definitely worthy of naming a book in honor of. Now, another wonderful entrepreneur that I met, I end the book with, and it's sort of, her story, I feel like, is not just inspirational in certain ways, but it's also a bit of a sobering warning. And this is it. So Fatuma, I met actually about 700-800-ish miles due south of where Patrick lived. Fatuma lived outside of Dodoma, Tanzania. And she was a charcoal seller. And when I met her, by the way, I should probably caveat all this by saying I was there meeting these entrepreneurs 10 years ago throughout Kenya and Uganda and Tanzania as an intern for a tiny nonprofit called Village Enterprise. And they provide $100, well, things have gone up. Now they do $150 grants, not even loans, just grants to individuals who are either too afraid to take a loan because they never have before, or everyone knows it's way too risky of a situation. They're just not quite ready to do anything beyond that. So Village Enterprise gave these grants. They're a wonderful organization, really helping people get on that first rung of the economic ladder. And I was there for 3.5 months interviewing entrepreneurs that they served, doing very basic sort of surveys, you know, standard of living surveys, questionnaires asking them, did you get the money? How did you use it? Are you happier now? What's changed in your life, et cetera? Trying to get at that social impact that we all hoped was there. So I met Patrick that way, and I met Fatuma that way as well. So when I showed up at her home, this mud structure that she had also built with her own two hands, she pulled me inside and was very eager to show me everything that she had to show about her business. Now, when she pulled me inside her home, it was very, oh, you know what? I thought that might be me, so don't worry about that. Did you see me feeling around? So when she pulled me inside her home, it was not, you know, I've been in some mud huts that are actually quite homey and well-lit and have a lot of, you know, furniture and stuff around, and it's quite cozy. This was bare. She had two chairs, a table, a mattress in the corner. That was it. And she had these little blue books. Does anyone remember blue books? I mean, I get this visceral, right? I get this stress reaction when I think about it, like, oh my gosh, it's middle school pop quiz essay time or something, right? But she had blue books here in rural Tanzania, and in these little books she had kept some records of her charcoal business. And as she showed me these very eagerly, she was very proud of them, and she should have been, I was blown away. I thought I had discovered this, like, let's make a movie about this, rags to riches story. It should have been that way, although I was confused because as she showed me not just recent but months and months worth of her records, she was doing incredibly well. But yet she lived in very, in a real state of need. She didn't have a lot of basics. I asked her about her standard of living, and she didn't have, I mean, I was shocked that if her business was doing so well, she didn't have, you know, basic things like mosquito nets. She wasn't sending her kids to school, not all of them anyway, not her daughters. She didn't have a lot of basic things that she clearly could have benefited from. So I dug into those numbers a little bit with her and asked her if they were really correct, if they were true, and she backed them up. They were legit. So completely baffled, basically, I asked her, so what's going on? I mean, you're doing well here with your business. Where are the profits? Where's the money that you've been making? And she sort of looked around as if there were other people in this one room place looking at us. She looked around, and she was a jokester, kind of got a smile on her face and tiptoed over to the other side of her hut, patted the ground and said, it's in the World Bank, and started to crack up. She had literally buried the money in the earthen floor next to where she slept. She had this pile of cash under there. So, I mean, we laughed, we had a chuckle. I mean, World Bank, it's a pretty good joke, and you don't get into, like, quickly into, you know, joking relationships with some folks, at least, that I had met during that time. We were talking about pretty serious stuff. So we laughed, and we enjoyed the moment, but then I asked her, really, is that what you've done? And it was. And she, you know, as I tried desperately to get more information from her about why this was. What I got back from her was not exactly contentedness, but just sort of this, I've just stopped. You know, my life will be fine, she said. My days will pass and I will be here. She didn't desire more. She didn't want to keep going and to keep growing and to make things better for herself. And since that day, I mean, I've met hundreds, if not thousands at this point, of entrepreneurs throughout East Africa and elsewhere. The good news is I haven't met too many Fatumas, but there are some. And I think one of the questions that contrast between a Patrick and a Fatuma has made me ask again and again of myself and of other people is, gosh, what makes some people dig and some people bury? Some people find, unearth value, almost create something out of nothing, right? And other people have such great promise, have so much potential, and maybe even have incredible resources, incredible gifts to go use and do things within the world, but they tuck them away and they either ignore them or just choose not to keep going and keep growing. So why the difference? Well, my best theory is that it does have something to do with entrepreneurship. That's not the complete answer, but it has something to do with this. And when I say entrepreneurship, it's a big word. I wish there was a shorter word, one that was like easier for elementary school kids to spell, for example. Anyway, so many syllables. But entrepreneurship, I wish that that was just the answer, but I think there's a little bit more there. The way I like to think about the definition of entrepreneurship is this. There's a Harvard Business School professor. I know we have one Stanford person in the back there, so I'm sorry I'm quoting a Harvard guy too, but Howard Stevenson says that entrepreneurship is the pursuit of opportunity without regard to resources currently controlled. Now, forgive me if I swoon a little bit, but I think this is just a beautiful and kind of romantic definition. I'll say it again. The pursuit of opportunity without regard to resources currently controlled. So to me, it's about this running after something, right? Regardless of what gets in your way, regardless of what you lack or what you stumble over, you just decide to go and to keep going. And it makes me think about, I think that's really the difference. Thank you guys for coming. I think that's really the difference between a Patrick and a Fatuma. I think people like Patrick keep going. Now, why do they, right? That would be the next question. Great, so some people keep pursuing regardless of what they lack or have lost or left behind, regardless of what they, those resources that they have, right, at that moment. I think people like Patrick keep going because they have a really good imagination muscle. They are really good at having a vision for the future, deciding that something can be different. They imagine what that could be. And they're not just good at imagining it, but they're really good at believing in it. They have great faith. They think, not only might this happen, but I think it will happen if only I keep going. So they're good at believing in that thing in the future. Okay, one more question here. So then, gosh, how do we all get better at that? How do we get better at envisioning something and kind of grabbing onto it and really believing that it's possible and then doing whatever it takes to get there? And I think it has to do with telling ourselves, and again, really believing in the right stories, not just about what's possible in the future, but about a lot of other things too. And I think sometimes it's hard to know which stories matter and which don't as we're going through life and which might sort of affect our trajectory and adjust these foundational beliefs, these values that we have that allow us to do the great things in the world, that allow us to envision something and go get it. But I think a lot of the stories that I know I heard growing up, for example, limited, I didn't know at the time, but they sort of limited what I thought about a lot of other people in the world. And ironically, those stories were told to me by really well-intentioned nonprofits and NGOs that were trying to do great stuff in the world. But they told me, again and again, as a potential donor, even as a middle-class American kid, I was a potential donor. So I heard a lot of stories from these well-intentioned organizations that told me there were poor people out in the world that really needed me to swoop in and save them. And that my job, the way I could swoop in and save them, was to give of my money, maybe sometimes give of my time, but I just had to sort of throw my change in the jar or call the 800 number, sponsor the child, whatever it was, do this kind of quick and usually, as the pitch would go, very quick, painless thing that I wouldn't even know happened, right? It would just be the cost of a cup of coffee a day, right? You could save a child's life. You wouldn't even have to really think about it. And then they would do the great work of actually making the change happen. But all I needed was to do this small thing to swoop in and help somebody else because that's what I was sort of told about them. There were stories about these other people. They were about sadness and suffering and desperation and hopelessness. And those stories, to me, made me, over time, start to believe less and less was possible for this whole group of people in the world, the poor. And that wasn't a good thing, because even though I had a nice long list of ways that I was involved, I gave to a lot of little nonprofits. I mean, I wasn't ever a high net worth donor, but I gave what I could. I, you know, threw my money in the jar, so to speak. But my heart was sort of closed off. I had erected this invisible barrier between me and these people that I so longed to help. And I think it was because, you know, I didn't believe a lot was possible for them. And I also was told in so many ways that really, at the end of the day, poverty isn't going away. Even in Sunday school, you know, a place where I think I heard 99% really wonderful, encouraging, life-giving sort of stories about redemption and possibility and all sorts of good things, I was told once in a while stuff that maybe I misinterpreted, but things that kind of, I think, got me off course too, like Jesus said the poor would always be with us. That was scary as a little kid to hear that. I thought, well, my gosh, even though it seems like I'm also being told that, you know, what you do for the least of these, you do for me. I'm being given this cosmic homework assignment, go serve the poor, it's a good thing. I wanted to do that. I felt very called to do that. But also, by the way, poverty's not going away. So good luck. I felt sort of defeated before I even began. And I think those two sets of emotions were perpetuated over time, and sadly, more so the second set of feeling a little over, not just a little, but feeling overwhelmed, maybe even guilty or shameful of my own relative middle-class American wealth. And again, this message that maybe, the story that maybe poverty was really just not going anywhere and the poor would always be with us. I mean, as an aside, I remember literally thinking that they would always be with me. Like, I would turn around, they'd want me to share my stuff with them, I'd be in a long line behind me, and while I wouldn't have, as a kid, used language like, well, this is unsustainable, I certainly felt like something's not going to work here, because I only have so much stuff to share. So anyway, sometimes we hear the wrong stories, but slowly over time, shut off possibilities for ourselves and for other people. For me, as a philosophy and poetry major undergrad, I mean, not only did I not care about entrepreneurship or business, but I thought it was bad. I thought the nonprofits, right, were the people, those were organizations helping people, and so therefore, for-profits were bad guys, and they were about taking, not giving. It was not quite that black and white, I know that now. But I mean, I didn't even think about studying anything related to business undergrad, so imagine, I graduate from college, I moved to California because I was in love with the boy. This is not prescriptive, this is just what happened. My mom's in the back and she was there's a theme in my story also of like worrying my mother. Sorry. Anyway, I moved to California and my first job out of undergrad with these newly minted philosophy and poetry degrees was to get a temp job at the Stanford Graduate School of Business. I just so happened to get that job in the Center for Social Innovation, this place I didn't know anything about when I walked in and handed my, yes, old school paper resume to the person behind the counter, the desk that was sitting there, who ended up saying, we actually need some help. Can you stay and work today? Not only did I end up landing there, but it was this incredible place, this Center for Social Innovation, where every day people were thinking about how to use business skills and entrepreneurial thinking to solve social problems. And I realized quite quickly that maybe I'd been wrong about this business stuff, and maybe there was actually something to be said for entrepreneurship that could be positive in the world. So I stayed. I stuck around. I did my job. I could pay my rent. It was good. And I ended up, my job changed and evolved, and I ended up at one point, 3 years in, staying late after work to hear this guy that was coming to campus speak. And this guy was Dr. Muhammad Yunus, and as many of you probably know, if you're here tonight, unless it was an accident and you just walked down because it was a last-minute decision, you probably know Dr. Yunus. He's, you know, seen often as sort of one of the grandfathers of modern microfinance, and he was, you know, in 2006 the winner of the Nobel Peace Prize for his work pioneering these products and services to help lift the poor out of poverty. This was the fall of 2003 when I heard him. I hadn't heard about him before. I had never heard this guy's name. I just was there, and I thought I would actually crash a lecture and sit in the back in case it was boring and I could go home early. But it was one of these moments that changed my life because it really galvanized for me a different story about poverty and potential, one that had this thread of entrepreneurship throughout it. He talked not only about microfinance, which was great, good big, you know, aha moment for me. Huh, financial services like, for example, microcredit, small loans that could, at the right moment in time, in the right hands, change somebody's trajectory. That was an amazing thing to learn about. But additionally, he talked about his story in a very accessible way, and it made me think maybe even I, as this philosophy major, could, I had no idea what to put on that resume, by the way. I just didn't know what I could do in the world. I wanted to help. I had no idea how, though. But his story starts out so simply where he's, you know, sitting with a group of women and is a really good listener. to them as he asks them questions about why they're stuck in a cycle of poverty. And they explain to him that they wake up every day. So Dr. Yunus started his work in Bangladesh. And so he's sitting in this village outside of, you know, he taught at the University of Chittagong in Bangladesh. And as the story goes, and I'm paraphrasing, one day sits down with this group of women in a nearby village, asks them why they think they're poor. Forget economic theory, just asks people directly, God forbid, right? Listens to them, and they explain their stories about waking up every day, having nothing to their names, borrowing money from a local moneylender, being charged 300, if not 3,000, and I'm not misspeaking there, percent interest, but having to go there is their only option to borrow money. They would buy materials to weave baskets, make a beautiful product, sell those products throughout the day, make a profit, but owe everything, if not more, back to the moneylender. So as he's listening to these stories, he, again, I'm totally shortening it, but he more or less says, well, what if I loaned you the money and didn't charge you 300% interest? So he does this, very sort of looking back, common sense thing to do. But no one was doing that at the time. Or very few were. And thus began his great work in the world. And so as I heard that part of the story, I thought, again, maybe naively, maybe I could go sit and listen to people really well. Maybe that's how I can do something good in the world. So it was really, really motivating. But maybe even more than those two things, wow, microfinance, wow, maybe I could do something in the world that starts with just being a great listener. Third, he talked about the poor in a way that didn't make me feel terrible about life and myself and like the problem was endless. In fact, he wasn't really talking about poverty too much. Anyway, he was talking about potential and entrepreneurship. He was talking about individuals who were smart and strong and hardworking and doing everything right. They just needed access to this little resource that I had access to most of my life, to go to college and do other things. That was game-changing for me. It was a new story about this group of people that I had totally otherized, and I totally thought I knew their story because I'd heard it again and again and again in the same-ish way from these NGOs and nonprofits. So all that to say, I was so inspired, I quit my job, moved that job at Stanford again, much to my mom's dismay, you hear the theme, much to her worry. I moved to East Africa, begged my way into a job there with Village Enterprise and meet people like Patrick and Fatuma and many, many others. And that's where the idea for Kiva was born. And Kiva, it's funny, there are case studies and all sorts of stuff written about Kiva at this point. And at this moment in time, like when I'm in East Africa working with the Fatumas and the Patricks of the world, there's often a line like, and then, you know, thus was born the idea for the world's first peer-to-peer microlending marketplace, blah, 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 crowdfunding. And I think, that's way too fancy. No, this is what was happening. I was inspired by these different stories from my new friends. I was calling my partner, Matt, back in San Francisco and saying, what if we did this? What if we did this? What if we, instead of gave money to these individuals, because no one was asking for a handout, some asked for loans, though. What if we told this new story of potential and poverty in a different way, and the world could hear this new perspective that had so inspired me? What if we loaned money to these individuals as much as we could, maybe just $25, $50 at a time? What if we put all this online? That was how Kiva started. We weren't using language like crowdfunding or really microfinance even that much. Just wouldn't it be great to stay in touch with our new friends and to stay in touch in a new way, exchanging money and information differently than we'd done before? So that was the sort of very basic what if set of questions that started Kiva. We began with $3,000 and 7 entrepreneurs in Uganda in the spring of 2005. By the fall of 2005, 6 months later, those 7 entrepreneurs had repaid. And again, having only then gone back to Stanford for my MBA, I finally went back and the money was going the other way that time. I paid, wasn't staff getting paid, but paid a pretty penny for my MBA at Stanford. I just started classes a month earlier. And we said, well, our pilot round of loans in Uganda with 7 whole entrepreneurs worked. Let's take the word beta off of the site and launch for real, which meant nothing. It meant we wrote our own press release and put it on our website and like waited for the world to discover us. The funny thing is, though, they did discover us. About a month later, 300 blogs had written about our little project. We had like 12 entrepreneurs on the site at that point. And in fact, of those 300 blogs, 2 of the 3 most widely read in the world had written about us. So suddenly, it wasn't just my mom, again, the theme here, my mom and my dad and our friends and family coming to the website. There were thousands and thousands of people that we had never met. Word had just spread of our little side project. And so over that first year, somehow, as I clawed my way through year 1 of my Stanford MBA, I had 5 tutors just for 4 classes, which I can do math. I had 2 for accounting. But I figured it out. I passed. Man, it was hard. So anyway, first year of my MBA, super difficult. And first year of Kiva, somehow we facilitated about $500,000 in loans. Second year, the total went up to 15 million, that second year. Third year, 40. Fourth year, about 100. Keeps about to cross $750 million, $750 million. Yay, lenders. Let's applaud lenders. And it was an amazing thing to get to be a part of. And it's, you know, we have over 100 staff in San Francisco. We have Kiva clubs in high schools, all sorts of good stuff. And it's just one part of my entrepreneurial journey. I've gotten to do other things as well, as my friend mentioned in the introduction here. But that's just one glimpse into sort of what's changed the narrative, the stories about potential in the world for me. And I think those stories, thank goodness, I mean, I'm very grateful that I've had all these experiences and exposure to entrepreneurs like Patrick, like Fatuma, and the many others that I've highlighted in this book. Those have changed what I believe is possible in the world, and not just for other people, but the great secret of all this is the more we believe about others, you know, the more we'll believe is possible for ourselves. So somehow along the way, by listening really well to them, I've been able to listen to my own heart and listen to and to believe in a different version of the future for myself and become an entrepreneur too, just like them. So that's kind of why I wrote this book. I want other people to be inspired as well by these stories, and I hope that others, especially the people sitting in this room and listening to this, I hope that these stories really can convince us to be more, I guess, strong and fervent believers that a different future is possible and that we have the power to envision it and to run after it with this amazing, beautiful sort of abandon that is described in that favorite definition of entrepreneurship that I mentioned. And just to close before we talk and have a conversation, you know, that's my third little boy back there in the stroller. I really do believe this. It might just sound like a nice, you know, I think stories are important. I genuinely try as I'm, you know, I have 3-year-old twins and my little 7-month-old boy, all boys. Yes, all boys. I'm a human jungle gym. But we talk about stories a lot. And as a little example, the other night we were reading to them Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. And my twins, Cyrus and Jasper, who are 3, they said, Mama, I won't do their, like, kid talk, but it's so tempting because it's so cute. But they asked me why Charlie Bucket's family was poor, and I thought, you've got to be kidding me. I did not expect this so soon. I'm like so ready for this. I've been waiting for this, but I realized I didn't know how to explain it to them. And I felt caught off guard. It was one of those great teachable moments, which I always think, is it more teachable for me than them? But, so I scramble and I think, so guys, you know, Charlie Bucket's family did not have enough resources to be able to do all the things they wanted to do in the world and to have all the opportunities they wanted. And they weren't given a lot of opportunities in the first place. That's, I think, why they were poor. And I thought, whew, did it. And then, of course, they come back with, well, what's opportunity, right? And I'm like, all right. And I say, well, you know how when you're playing with the toy, and they're twins, they have learned to share, you know, since they could do anything, since they could grab at each other. But I said, you know how when you're playing with something and your brother wants a turn, it's really important to share and to give them a turn. Well, an opportunity is like a turn. It's like when you get your chance to go down the slide at the playground or to play with the toy that you want. Not everyone gets the same amount of turns, unfortunately, but we can help make that happen because we can share and we can help other people have turns. And I was really thankful because the questions paused for a few more chapters, which was great. And I think I just put that out there as I guess a reminder to all of us, it's really simple stuff, actually. We just need to start and keep perpetuating telling the right stories again and again about ourselves, about the world, and about what's possible in the lives of everyone around us. Thank you. So I would love to hear what you're thinking and to just have a conversation. Yes?
Well, it's wonderful to hear the story. I've never known a lot of detail about it. Great to have you here and telling it. I'm immediately wondering about the jump when suddenly all the decimal places started growing and the amount of money handled. And yes, staff in San Francisco or whatever, but what about on the ground? How do you actually manage interacting with the receivers of the benefits of your organization?
Sure.
And how is that handled and how did it handle growth?
Mm-hmm. Question. And my little caveat here is because I've left and done other things, I'm not full-time staff at Kiva. I mean, the analogies for me now are all about mothering, and so I feel like the grandma. Like, I get to be really proud and show off pictures, but I am not changing the dirty diapers every day anymore. So with that caveat, so the way Kiva's traditionally worked is as follows. There are lenders, the platform itself, these lending organizations, these field partners, a lot of microfinance institutions, banks for the poor, like Grameen-esque organizations. But there are a lot of other non-traditional ones too now, just nonprofits that happen to have a loan element as part of their offering to people. Anyway, so lenders, Kiva, these field partners, and borrowers. So the field partners are the ones that really find, they know their communities, they're the experts on the ground, they find borrowers, administer loans, collect repayments, actually have individuals that are designated to sort of put the information up on Kiva, for example. But they're in the world operating with or without Kiva. There are 10,000 plus of those kinds of institutions. It is direct. It just goes, it's direct and it goes through their hands as well. And it needs to. A lot of the actual end borrowers are not online. They are not, some are not literate, right? There needs to be someone in between for a lot of those exchanges. That said, there's also, that's kind of classic Kiva. There's sort of Kiva 2.0, Kiva Zip is what it's called. And it's been pioneered over the last few years, and it's pretty exciting and revolutionary. So lenders, Kiva, a trustee, just a person, and then the end borrower. And so in the U.S., we can do this, and it's being done in Kenya as well. It's being done elsewhere. But it's worked really well in the U.S. because, you know, microfinance looks so different here and in more developed areas of the world. Microfinance looks so different here than it does in a lot of other places. For example, village banking, you know, group borrowing is quite common. Can you imagine if you walked into a bank here, regardless of the amount of collateral you had or not, but just anybody walking into a bank wanting a loan and having the person behind the counter say, well, you need to go find 9 friends, and by the way, if you default, they're on the hook for you, and it's just different. And so, and also we have credit scores, we have other things here, other pieces of information. Now, the rest of the world is catching up fast, and it's very fun and exciting to watch, and we have a lot to learn from them too, but this sort of lighter version of Kiva is possible in certain structures, in certain scenarios. It's very mobile, very light, faster, et cetera. Does that answer your question? It's kind of like a lot of information, but great. What else? Anything? My threat is I will tell you kid stories if you don't ask a question. Do you have a question? I'm cold calling now. This is great. Yeah.
You said in the book, and you said earlier that you've been, in the book you've been thinking a lot about her, and you mentioned that. And it seems to me your thought pattern is about where you were 10 years ago. Would that be accurate? Have you seen her since?
No. I wish I would have, but what happened was I did these impact surveys, you know, pencil and paper for 3.5 months without a smartphone, without much of anything. I burned out two computers. I mean, I blew up laptops, right? I got the data. It served its purpose, but a lot of it has been just lost along the way. I didn't think I would write this book 10 years later. So I haven't kept in touch. I don't know if I could find her again because the surveys were quite randomized and sometimes anonymous. So anyway, that's my, unfortunately I haven't, but yes, follow on.
So the follow up would be the happiness index.
Yeah.
Bhutan.
I know.
We're beyond all the material goods.
Totally.
We have something to learn from her.
Totally.
With nothing, but she's not a happy, she didn't seem like
wish I could say that, right? I mean, actually, though, I feel like it's tough. I actually like that she is this nuanced character in my past, right? Because I definitely had, I don't want to call it a phase or something that sounds at all diminutive. Like, look, some of my first encounters with abject poverty, like in high school when I went to Haiti on a mission trip with my church, I remember coming back and thinking, but the kids were so happy, and that was a real comfort to me. But that's not the full story. That's part of their story. There is joy sometimes when we're not pinned down by a lot of material things, but there are definitely needs that those kids had and that Fatuma had that I think would have increased, let's just say at very least, physical wellness, her own security, things like that, right? So it's not like I was there just to say, are you happy? And I wouldn't say that she pops to mind as one of the happiest people that I've met over time. Sometimes I have met very, very happy people in unexpected places like that. But I think it's too simple of a story to say, oh, look, they have so little, but yet they're so happy, so we don't have to worry about them. I know that's not necessarily what you're getting at, but I feel like that's done sometimes. That's a way that people cope with encountering tough stuff. Do you agree?
I agree with the concept of what you're doing, that we have something to learn from them.
I totally agree with you. To say something related, I think also we, like, in, once I started to wake up to this power that at least some kinds of business principles and business thinking have to make great changes in the world, you know, you encounter a lot of people that say, well, nonprofits have a lot to learn from business. It's like, it's a tax code, not a religion, right? It's not like nonprofits have the corner market on social impact and that businesses have the corner market on being really efficient and smart about capital or whatever. I mean, I think you can find incredible truths and lots of wisdom and great, you know, great things to learn from all kinds of organizations, whatever their tax structure. You had a question?
Well, I was just going to follow up that I haven't read the book, so I haven't read the chapter on Fatima, but what was her vision for?
Well, exactly, right? That was just the point. She, I think what happened for her, this is my best kind of interpretation as I've thought about it, I think she had made some changes. They were very, very hard for her to articulate. And maybe even she just, in quotes here, she just became a more confident person in her ability to go earn a living and, like, survive every day, because that's a good thing to do. Maybe she had just felt like she had reached her own point of, well, I have enough or I've done enough. Maybe. That's a good version that I tell myself. But I think there's also probably something about, like we said, I mean, a lack of ability to imagine that things could be much different and to really believe that she could get there. She could keep going and keep growing. And I think she was afraid. By the way, there's also something to be said for, you know, when, as far as I have observed, because I have not experienced this myself, but one characteristic of living in abject poverty is this incredible volatility. I mean, things may be good one day and terribly awful the next. So to have a buffer, I mean, saving is a really good thing. So she, in her own way, was doing that. I think she overdid it. I think it could have been done a lot differently. But, you know, in fact, there's this trend now. I mean, I see a lot more excitement around micro savings programs and micro insurance and things that sort of inject a little bit more stability into the lives of socioeconomically disadvantaged people. I don't like saying poor so much. I think that's kind of old language, but...
Well, maybe for her, having that safety net, that,
yeah,
that cash buried is like, you know, like your grandmother who had the cash under the bed,
yeah,
in a box.
Yep, yep.
You know, maybe, yep, that was a vision.
Maybe it was.
Maybe that,
I, yep, maybe. I asked her, I mean, I tried. I am happy to blame myself and to think, hey, I just didn't ask the right questions, an important skill. And I just really was just learning how to do that. So maybe I just didn't ask in the right way or with an open enough, you know, maybe I wasn't listening well enough or something, right? Who knows? It could have been me. But as far as I could tell, she didn't have these great dreams for much else in her life. She was just sort of happy to stay where she was and not make change. And again, she had tattered clothing. Her shoes were kind of falling off her feet. There were a lot of really basic things. It's not like I was hoping that she'd become some sort of materialist or want to go buy 10 cell phones or something. I just thought there's some real basic stuff. Nutrition, you know, again, mosquito medicine, things like that. Yes.
You mentioned about the power of listening and just how that has been important to your clothing. I was just wondering if that's something that you feel like you've always been naturally good at, or has there been, like, opportunities or certain things that have always helped you become a better listener, and what are some ways that you can,
yeah,
do that?
I would say, again, let's just I'm going to keep going to that corner of the room. My mom will back this up. I've been good at talking always, but I don't know about listening. Listening has definitely been much more of a learned skill, and I still have a lot to learn and a lot more to do to grow as a listener. But there have been lots of moments when I've been really humbled, and I go back to those, again, stories to remind myself that I just need to, you know, shut my mouth and listen a little bit or ask a really good question and then shut up. For example, and I do tell this story somewhere in the book, I think about halfway through, there's a woman that I talk about, I'm doing one of these surveys with, and I ask her about her business, and things are great, things are improving. It wasn't this as extreme as a success story as Fatima's, but she was great. Her name's Innocent in the book. And she talks about how, oh yeah, my business is going well, and in fact, one of the first things she did to change her own life was buy sugar to put in her tea. And I remember hearing this and thinking, what? Like, why would you do that first? Why was that so important to you? You should definitely have different priorities. I was very judgmental in my head at that time because I was, again, it was the first few weeks. It was a really dangerous point because I was a whole few weeks into my field work. So I felt like I was learning a lot, and I was so eager. I wanted to be an expert, and I wanted to be good at my job and all that. But I had started to make assumptions and started to guess that I knew this person's story, or I at least knew what should happen in her story. So I knew enough to be dangerous. That was the sweet spot for me. But so anyway, she said, oh, now I can put sugar in my tea. Thank goodness I kind of held my tongue, buttoned my lip, and I the only thing I said was something like, tell me more about that, or can you tell me why? And she explained how when she had sugar to put in her tea, not only could she do that for herself, and it was this daily sweetness in her life that she enjoyed, but now she had sort of the full experience of tea with, you know, milk and sugar in teacups, you know, to offer, or little mugs, actually, but to offer to guests. So she could suddenly invite guests into her home with all this confidence, and so she started to do that more and more frequently. It really grew her own self-esteem and sort of established her more of a leader in her community. It changed everything for her. It changed how she saw who she was in the world around her. And so she actually was quite good at explaining all this to me. And I was very humbled because I thought, well, okay. At that moment in time, I wanted so bad to help. Had I been given, you know, the magic wand and told, go fix things, I would have confidently said, thank you so much, here I go. And I would have gone and thought that I could do that. I know now that I can't. Nobody could do that. The best thing we can do is to give other little magic wands, I guess, if this is the analogy I'm using, to other people so they can make those changes for themselves. So I think that was one moment that really helped me. And then throughout other ventures that I've started and, you know, on a daily basis, I just have to remind myself that even when I think I know this, I think I know what's going on here, it's probably a good idea to err on the side. Thank you. To err on the side of asking more questions and listening more than would come naturally to me, to come back to exactly how you phrased the question, because it doesn't. It's not an easy thing for me all the time. Good question. I bet it is for you. At least a little bit more than me. Yeah?
So another question.
It's great.
You mentioned when you were in East Palo Alto, during that period you were on a board, you were living in the woman's shelter,
yeah,
type of thing.
Yeah.
And you mentioned you quit the board because, you know, there was too much praying going on at the board meetings. But
yes,
I'm sure there's
as more. One thing, but yes.
Yes. We're here, and I'm sure there's others. We're working on a small nonprofit. We're trying to involve young people with scholarships and so on, and we've invited people on our board to attend board meetings, and with mixed success. And it seems like not a real natural thing for a young person who wants to,
yeah,
go out and save the world to be on a board.
Oh, yeah, the board thing was weird.
So
but
any comments about,
sure,
youth or a new model,
oh,
that,
sure,
that you may have experience with?
Yeah.
With it's old folks and young folks,
well,
sitting together?
Well, it's a good question. So I'll say this. So to clarify one thing.
Yes.
It's not like it wasn't, oh, this board prays too much, I'm out. It was more like it was definitely, I wanted a little less talk, a lot more action kind of thing. And I also felt like the ways in which we were going about getting what we needed as a team, as an organization, were not strategic. It was more bake sales and car washes, less, like, I thought, you know, less groundbreaking stuff, and less what I wanted to do and what I was really interested in, and being really proactive and trying to make things sustainable and trying to be really serious about what impacts were happening and what weren't. There was a lot of... So the story, which I hope all of you will read in the book, is a little bit about also sort of measuring and tracking the impact of an organization versus relying on and being really okay with the assumption that invisible change is happening, which I believe also happens in people's lives. But it's nice to be able to see at least some of that over time and be able to correlate that to the hard work and money that you're putting into an effort. So anyway, in terms of getting folks involved on boards, you know, I think... This is a very, I'll say something very general and then more specific. So very generally, I think when you invite an individual, like you find a specific individual, not like, hey, I'm going to do this email blast to the class of 2015, or like when you reach out to a group, I don't think that's a very effective way to do much of, you know, anything. But when you can reach out individually to people and say, I see this in you, I see this great quality in you, or I really think you could add this. I'm going to invite you into this very specific role. So a specific person, specific, ask, specific request. I feel like that's incredibly powerful. And you can do that one at a time, person by person. So that's kind of what I would say. Figure out a way to get to know potential sort of board candidates, if you will, and invite them in really specific personal ways that makes them feel special. I think that's a good thing. I also think to invite younger people onto boards, knowing that, there are a lot of theories on sort of how to design a great board. So I have a lot of analogies in my head. I'm not sure which ones to use, but sometimes you hear about the workhorses and the show horses, right? Or you either raise the money or you donate the money. There's like a little saying, fund or find, something like that, right? You fund the money or you find it. I think I've been invited on boards where I definitely was on a board over the last decade where I was the youngest by 20 years, mm-hmm. 20 years, and I was definitely the lowest donor by at least $30,000. I mean, everyone else had to give this enormous amount of money, and I didn't because I couldn't. But I tried to give of my time and give in other ways. So I think if you can be really malleable and flexible and creative with everyone stepping up, everyone knows their responsibilities, but obviously there are not that many younger people that can be these big donors the way some others who have worked really hard over their lives and have accrued some wealth can do. So I think opening it that way is really helpful too. Is that helpful? Yeah? All right. Yes?
I haven't really fully developed the question, but...
I love these kind of questions. Just, I'm here with you. We're good.
So I see a lot of nonprofit organizations as providing goods and services primarily. And so is there still a place for those organizations in this world, or is entrepreneurship and microfinance the way of the future? Is that what we should be?
Oh, gosh. No. I mean, look, I think there are certain values, certain qualities, and kind of ways that organizations are run that I look for and that I love. But in fact, and it's really funny you opened your question with that sort of like, it's not fully formed, because this answer is not fully formed. But I've been thinking about this actually for months, and I keep jotting down little notes, and I will, if you give me your email, I will send you, when I write this blog post or I write this piece, it's close, but here's where I am. Here's my theory. I actually think there's been this swing, there's been this swing over toward everything has to be sustainable. Everything has to be, sustainable and profitable are kind of the same words, just different sectors, right? Sustainable is nonprofit speak for profitable. Everything has to be, long-term, but for real, right? There's just, you know what I'll do? I'll make a little word guide. When you hear a nonprofit person saying this, that's what this means, right? Or vice versa. Anyway, I'm serious. Oh boy, that would be fun to do. Note to self, future blog posts. But here's the thing. I actually think that there's going to be a swing back towards just like emergency relief work or providing real physical things, because everything's online. All the ways we get involved, a lot of ways we get involved nowadays are quite virtual, and you just click a few times and that's your service. I just joined the board of Habitat for Humanity in part, and I know I can just go do builds whenever I want. We all can. It's a great thing. We should all do it. But I want to get back to like physical, brick by brick, literally, right, sort of contributions in the world, too. And I think there's going to be swing back towards just pure charity. Like, I actually was talking to a friend who does amazing investing, like really cutting-edge sort of values-based investing. He invests in sharing economy-related stuff the way I've done with the Collaborative Fund. But I love this guy. I think so highly of him. And he was like, last week, I was just walking down the street, and there was the same homeless guy I always see, and I never give him money because I have all these theories of change and stuff, but I just reached into my pocket and gave him everything I had, and it was really irrational, but it felt so good, and I just kept walking. Now, this is a guy whose job is, like, socially responsible investing. I mean, he may as well, carry around a manifesto of, like, here's the way I believe social change happens in the world, like, 80 pages, right? And he just decided to give because he was there, and he responded because he had a desire to and a feeling. And I think there's got to be a way to honor that again and honor that more in people and not just be so in our heads about it. I mean, maybe I'm just projecting, but I feel like that's happening. And all this is being recorded, and there's my half-baked answer. But did that answer your question? Did I kind of answer a little bit? Well, you're asking more about, well, did I answer it? How do you feel? Quality control on my answer. Really? Oh, okay. I want to tell. Ask me again. Push again. What?
I'm excited for your blog post.
Okay, good. Thanks. Somewhere, someday.
I think you began to address it just how.
Sorry.
I really do like how on Kiva you have the 4 or 5 sentence blurb about the person that you're lending to, but it seems so artificial. All of our banking account is online. You click 3 buttons and it
right.
sends money to this person. You don't get that human-to-human interaction. I think that's what you
Amen. That's,
begin
yeah.
to speak on. It's just the power of these stories. We lose a little bit of that when we're so
yeah.
online and virtual.
That is absolutely how I feel. I'm so with you. I'm serious. I will write this thing, and now I have a catalyst to write it sooner than later. I think there's also a danger in, look, there are a lot of organizations that say, we're like the Kiva for this. And Kiva's, we didn't invent everything that they mean when they say that, but I often say, thanks, that's great, and just go with it. But there are a lot of other ways now to, like, read someone's particular story and contribute, right? A lot of other crowdfunding sites, there's a lot. I think we might be reaching a saturation point, too, with these stories, where even if you're saying it's a few sentences, even if it were paragraphs, I think it's hard to absorb that. And if you want to do, you know, not just one $25 loan, but 10 of them, it's a lot to take in and to really feel and appreciate. And so I'm going to figure out, you know, I don't know, there's the slow food movement, slow other things movement. There's slow money, too. What's the slow, you know, philanthropy? Is there slow philanthropy? Is there, maybe I'll go with that. Is there slow, I'm thinking out loud here, is there slow charity, slow something? There's something where I'm with you. I think we need to, like, slow down and experience it differently. And, you know, these virtual interactions are here to stay. So it's probably going to be at least with that as a supplement, if not still the main way through which we do this. But I love when it's actual, real, again, like you said, person to person, live, face to face interactions. And I've noticed in my own life that's declined over the last few years. It's also because I'm raising 3 very tiny boys, and it's hard to drag them everywhere, but they're pretty awesome. Wait, I wanted to say one other thing about this, because it's a really good question. But if I think of it, I will. Maybe we go to another question until I do. And we can talk after, too. We all can. Yes.
I have kind of an innocent and uninformed question. But, you know, we're talking a lot about nonprofits and profits. And really, what is the difference in
yeah.
your world between a nonprofit and a profit? Because it seems to me like some nonprofits, like healthcare, the healthcare industry, like Primera is a nonprofit, but it makes a lot of money and pays its vice presidents a lot of money. So how do you know when you're reaching out in the nonprofit world to do good that the nonprofit isn't just really making a lot of money and paying its top officers a lot of money? How do you check them out?
Well, so there's Charity Navigator. There's a bunch of online resources, and I can even, like, send you an email or write them down or something. I'm, like, more than happy to do that. But I will actually answer this maybe in a different way. So technically speaking, it's really about this, you know, tax structure, and do the profits of the company stay in the company, or do they go out and make shareholders wealthy? Now, look, there can be, so Kiva has been a sustainable, that means profitable, organization in the past at times, right? Does it line my pockets? No. It goes back into the organization to grow it. Do I think it's bad when nonprofit professionals make high salaries? Not necessarily at all. In fact, I think it's great that we can create these publicly owned entities, 501c3s, and all sorts of other hybrid organizations that exist now, including, which we should talk about, B Corps, which is a big deal. It's a very big deal. There are now organizations that can be for-profit, but yet have this social mission baked in so that, I mean, look, traditional for-profit traditional for-profits are required by law to make decisions that maximize profits to shareholders. So let's just say you have 2 organizations. One's a B Corp, one's just a traditional for-profit. And let's say They're each deciding on different vendors to use. And they find one that they know treats workers terribly, but they can get the thing that they need, the supply that they need for a dollar a unit. Great. There's another one that is amazing and doesn't pollute the environment and treats workers really well and all these other great things, but it costs a dollar and one penny, right? One, it costs, or $1.50 even, let's make it a more extreme, per unit. No, it's better to do that. Let's say this one's 99 cents and this one's a dollar, okay? It's literally, they can literally go, it's illegal for them to make this decision to go after the, you know, to work with the more fair supplier that's doing all these other great things in the world, because technically they're not maximizing value to shareholders. So they could be called out on that, called out on a decision like that if this other option is available. So the fact that there are B Corps that say, look, we also value social impact, we also value these things, and they stated in their bylaws, they now have legal backing to make that other decision, which is a very big deal, even if they're for profits. But let's get back to this other thing. And I'm not, I mean, I feel like, you know, I don't really know you, but we're friends here, so I'm just going to push a little bit, but bear with me. So you made a point of saying this nonprofit pays their execs really well, and that I'm assuming you think is not a good thing. What I find crazy is that our metrics for what's a good nonprofit and an honorable nonprofit and what's not are often these real quick sort of bullet point things like, well, what's their overhead? Oh, they spend more than 10% on overhead? Well, that must not be very efficient. Or they pay, I'm sorry, their nonprofit executive director makes $120,000. That is just a crime. We'll find these little bits that make us think, well, they must be not good. I think the better questions to ask are like, what are they doing in the world? What are they producing? Does it cost a little bit more money, overhead, you know, paying staff, whatever it is? Does it cost more money to, I don't know, find this cure for a cancer, or to do the most incredible microfinance work, or to do something that's really genuinely of an incredible social impact? If that's the case and they're really getting the job done, I think that that's often justifiable. I'm using you as an example here, so forgive me for sort of calling you out there. But, you know, it's not like we, at least not very many people that I've ever met, go around saying, well, I was going to buy that iPhone, but have you seen Apple's overhead? It is crazy. Yeah. They say, no, I like this product. This is a great thing. I value this, so I'm going to buy this thing. They don't, yes, they make values-based decisions, but I don't think there's necessarily a correlation between higher overhead, for example, and being a not good organization.
Right, and that wasn't actually my point. My point was trying to determine what nonprofits are really out there doing the right thing instead of just posing as a nonprofit to line the pockets.
I hear you. Well, they shouldn't be able to just line their pockets without a responsible board of directors, like, keeping checks on them. And those boards, you know, those directors can't be lining their pockets, legally speaking. So they're contributing money and they're donating. So hopefully those boards are, on the public's behalf, keeping those other organizations accountable. Hopefully that's sort of where, that's like level one, where it should be happening. But otherwise, I think it's up to, again, these other ratings organizations. GuideStar is one, Charity Navigator is one. There's a bunch of others too. But they sort of help illuminate which organizations are really doing great work and what it's costing to do that and which aren't.
Great, that's very helpful.
Oh gosh, I'm so glad. Good. I'm glad I answered it appropriately. And you had a question in the back.
I did.
And this is the last one.
Okay.
But no pressure.
So it better be a good one.
Better be a great one.
I'm sort of wondering, you know, the work that Q has done is awesome. You know, three quarters of $1 billion over the last decade or so, right?
Mm-hmm.
But we've got this weird payday lending thing in mm-hmm. the U.S. that did, like, you know, they do $46 billion a year.
A little bit more than Kiva.
It's a little bit bigger, and it's a lot more, like, it's a lot more expensive. It's definitely predatory lending.
Yeah.
Like, how do we get organizations that are much more, you know, much more local,
So the question about payday lending, I think, you know, the easy thing for me to say is, well, Kiva Zip's starting to chip away at that, and it is, and it's great, but there need to be better options for people. I do think that not just legislation, like the Jobs Act passed a few years ago, And that's going to open things up a little bit, not for this particular thing, but for unaccredited investors to be able to participate and play and create more wealth for themselves, which will be good. But I think the world's getting more and more used to and open to and comfortable with more crowdfunding-based options. So people can sort of create, these more for the people, by the people banking opportunities or opportunities to get loans, and it won't be from these payday lenders that are being so abusive. So I don't have a real silver bullet answer, but I think there are lots of organizations starting to try to solve that problem. And again, I'm happy to talk more about you with that, because it's without just listing them off. I think it's slowly starting to happen. Thank you for the questions, everyone. I really appreciate y'all being here. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this podcast of Speakers Forum from KUOW 94.9 Seattle. If you liked what you heard, you might leave a good review. It'll help other listeners find us. Jessica Jackley's new memoir is Clay, Water, Brick: Finding Inspiration from Entrepreneurs Who Do the Most with the Least. She spoke at the Elliott Bay Book Company on Monday, July 27th, 2015. Thanks to Jenny Cecil Moore for our recording. Tune in next week for another great talk. For Speakers Forum, KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm John O'Brien.